Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... Okay, Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. This is the last full chapter, is that right? No, the second last chapter, and let's do it. We're up to nearly page 600, so what a megalith of a... short story of a thing. It's not short at all. As always, it begins with two quotes. The first quote is by Walt Whitman. When I sit, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon uncomfortable I became tired and sick, till rising, gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stairs. Walt Whitman. By the Rigid Vita, Vita, which is an ancient text, let us obtain the adorable splendor of the sun. May he arouse our minds. Okay. Sol soccer et redire poussant, wrote Cutters. Suns can set and rise again. In English, the word sunset goes back to at least the 1440s. Shakespeare, as one would expect, wrote of it. So too Milton, Byron, Longfellow, Frost, Ginsberg, Emerson, as well as many other writers of less fame. Different languages summon up different associations. The French solo couchant, for instance, or the German Abendrot, meaning red glow in the evening sky. It's nearly all cultures, the splendors of that light up the horizon, the sun's going down, are celebrated for their beauty exploited as a symbolic potential. Films, this is what the sunset in Ganges, films and sometimes books, and with the hero and heroine departing into the sunset, deathbed sayings are often sunset references for Tiberius's contemptuous dismissal of his attendants. You know when to abandon the setting and hasten the rising of the sun. To Jung's, help me out of bed, I want to see the sunset. Stephen Vincent Bennett, 1898-43, won the Pulitzer Prize for his book-length poem, John Brown's Body, in which he describes Brown's majestically plain address in the court, being sentenced to death. Here is the peace unbegged, here is the end. Here is the insolence of the sun cast off. Here is the voice already fixed with night. This man is an absolute literary genius. It was just a shame about the science. And this is not this author, but the author of that poem, but the author of this book. Whether seen an ocean or across a vast prairie from a great height or simply inside a city flat, sunsets are vivid experiences that move people ever and everywhere, sometimes to melancholy, elsewhere to rapture. Winston Churchill in his later days would travel to the Atlas Mountains to paint because sunsets in the desert's edge are so exquisite. Well, Winston Churchill, is there anything that doesn't amaze me? Thomas Hardy, when a boy, would sit on the stairs at his parents' home and watch. The evening sun awoke a special intensity of an entire sunset, with no action except a dying light and a jet's contrail drawing across the sky. During the imperial entertainments, he put on the British East Africa between the wars. I don't quite understand this. Okay. Oh, this is a different thing. A prodigiously rich Sir Philip Sasson, cousin of the poet, had the Union Jack hauled down from his mansion's roof because the colours clashed with the evening sky. Rangers in Sierra Nevada National Park are said to be paid in sunsets, while every evening at the 18th hole at Pebble Beach Golf Course in California, a bagpipe laments the close of the dying day. Perhaps no one on Earth, however, has seen a sunset spectacular as those viewed from space. Astronauts have spoken, being overwhelmed by the prismatic radiance spreading across the face of the Earth. Artists, of course, are particularly responsive. Van Gogh wrote sunsets during his during the Mistral. Quote, towards the sunset, it generally glows a little calmer. That's true. That's when we stand to in the army. And then there's a superb effect in the sky, Citron. Mournful pounds, silhouettes standing out of relief against the exquisite black lace effects. Sometimes the sky is red, sometimes extremely delicate neutral tone, again pale citron, but neutralized by delicate lilac. In 2007, a group of scientists produced a study of 554 paintings of sunsets, including Turner's 115 renderings, as well as works by Claude, Rubens, Rembrandt, Gainsborough, Hogarth, Copley, Degas, Caspar, David Friedrich, Alexander Cousin, and Gustav Klimt, to help understand the changes in climate. They found 118 artists who had painted sunsets between 1500 and 1900. Then use computer to work out the proportion of red and green along each picture's horizon. As we now know, the magnificence of sunsets depends on the cloud formation or the level of particles in the air. The more airborne particles, the more sunset scatters the light towards the red. So the dustier the sky, the redder the sunset. The most of the paintings with the highest green-red ratios were painted in 3 years following the documented eruptions after being the 54 such volcanic sunsets. Turner all unknowingly recorded the effects of three. Those of Timor, now in Indonesia in 1815, Babu in the Philippines, and Kostya in Nicaragua in 1835. Her painters are not savants attempting to precise dictation of nature. It is interesting to realize that such visions as the fighting Temari, once sharply criticized for its outrageous culling, may be a truer representation than one thought. Dear. One of the several sunset sites on the internet publishes a list of the world's top 10, Key West, Florida, and it goes through Giza, Egypt, Anchorage. Australia doesn't get in there. Hawaii, and in the first place, a village of Sanori, the shattered volcanic Greek island. I don't begrudge each its appeal, but I wanted to witness sunset and meant something in addition to being visually spectacular. In October 2006, I set off not for Hawaii, Los Angeles, but for the city of Varanasi on the bank of the Ganges, taking a few sun-related side trips along the way. Well, he started off doing the sunrise in Slavi. Sunrise and Sunset, his book is The Sun. I love this book. After landing New Delhi and visiting Jaipur and its famous ancient observatory, I flew to Udaipur, about 250 miles further south, October, at the mouth of Dowi, the Hindu festival of light. And 21st of October, I arrived in Udaipur, their new year. I had arranged that night to see Maharana and Arvind Singh Merwa, sounds like one of my students, along the Sarji noble leader, and received at my hotel a printed invitation for my summons, the envelope embossed with sun supporting a mighty whirly moustache, assembled emblem of virility. At 6:50 p.m. I presented myself to Sambal National Palace, the building ablaze with the festival lights, Darwali lights, and was led to a large patio overlooking the famous Udaipur where Shinye was waiting. He was little more than 5'3", his outsized head adorned by a fittingly luxuriant moustache and a bald, full beard beneath the lazy, watchful eyes. 62 years old, as he told me, he was wearing light-coloured trousers and an untucked striped shirt and loafers, as if holidaying at a caravan resort. He asked a manservant for a gimlet, gin of lime, and a gimlet, and looked disappointed when I opted to stay non-alcohol. Now, what would you like to know? Having learned that he had an interest in solar energy, I asked him for his 14 sun-powered vehicles for hire. Of the 7-geared pedaled rickshaw with the 2 75-watt panels of scooters on the 12-volt lead-acid batteries and on the river Sarja-powered water taxi. Sarja was already known as India's solar state. Oh, dear. Siraji's response was brisk. Oh, yes, all of that. It's really not important. He turned instead to his family tree. His roots go back to 569 and ultimately descended from the sun, which is why his family crest shows the star so prominently. For me, the sun is a human being, he said easily. Really? A massive gaseous human? Without a missing a skip, he replied, well, maybe not a human being, but in terms of spirit energy, yes. And what it gives us, I do mean that the sun connects in a special way. He's a god, a part of us. I'm not an intellectual, but it's what I feel. And I suppose that's what I'm saying about how we relate to the sun. People in the West seem to have lost the connection, to have lost their way. I think we need to redefine divinity, he went on, because the sun is divine, not only in the way the word is used in your part of the world. It does not bring us light and take away the darkness. Each of us needs to find the sun in ourselves. The star has certainly endowed him with more than average energy. In his youth, he had been a fine cricketer, able to bat, who represented the Rajasthan. And more recently, he had overseen the building of a dozen museums and libraries, put together a vintage car collection, formed a polo club. He's obviously fabulously wealthy. Formed a polo complex, managed a successful stud find, pioneered local music initiatives, and helped the post-university course in hotel management. Had doubled his chain of palaces into luxury hotels. He was chairman of three gem companies and several religious educational trusts. In an era when most Indian princes are looking for a role and worrying about money, Indira Gandhi abolished the princedom in 1971. He has both. Oh, well, there you go. So Indira Gandhi, and it's really interesting, Indira Gandhi was a complete dictator. By the time I left the palace, Sirja had given me more than two hours of his time. 3 years later, in July 2009, the Prime Minister of India dedicated his country to the most ambitious solar energy development program in the world. All government buildings have to have solar panels by 2012, and 20 million households are to have installed solar lighting by 2020. To achieve these similar goals, the government plans to invest $220 billion. But Suraji was the pioneer. Over the next 4 days, I visited Modera in Gurjar to see one of the great sun temples, thence to Allahabad, Delhi, and finally to my ultimate destination, Varanasi, where I was to meet my guide, Ravid. It means sun, he told me. Age 38, he looked like a lead from a Bollywood movie, except he was too slim and too jowly, and with his hair too obviously treated with henna. Black. One of the taller Indians I had met, he strode gangly and loose-limbed in the sockless shoes, a silver bracelet on his right arm. Over the next 3 days, he would oversee my education. Varanasi is Hinduism's holiest city and predates the modern metropolis of India. Chennai, Madras, Mumbai, Bombay, Kolkata, Calcutta, and New Delhi by at least 2,000 years, making it one of the most ancient in the world, as old as Jerusalem. It is permanently populated. It has a permanent population of 1.1 million. There are faithful come to die or their bodies are brought to be cremated, as was Mrs. Gandhi's, so absolving them of the burden samasa of reincarnation. No city is more symbolic of Indian culture, but Benares, the ruling British attempts to Mongol version of the ancient Hindu name, until independence, it was also known as Kashish, from the Sanskrit words to shrine, the city of light. The wordplay underlines the relationship of the name and to enlightenment, where there was here that India's most famous seeker, Siddharan Gautama, putting aside his life of luxury, preached his first sermon. Before long, he was named Buddha. Hinduism, Buddha was was in Hindu, but he was a British a prince. All the gods of the Hindu pantheon are manifest in Kashi. No need to go anywhere else, say the locals. Everything the soul requires is present. But while primarily a holy city hosts 1,500 temples, it's also renowned for its university. Foreign visitors have named it the Athens of India, as well as courteous poets, thugs, brass shops, silk palaces, mangoes, pan leaves, even its sweets. The first day, Ravid guided me to Lakara Kund, meaning Trembling Sun, one of the two shrines mentioned in that supreme Sanskrit epic of ancient India, the Mahabharata. The shrine was set in a small square similar to those behind the main palazzo in Venice. But from this simple rectangle, 35 steep steps descended to a bathing pool 50 feet down. I remember this. And the shrine was built up to its current size by a local ruler in the 18th century. After his bathing here, he cured his leprosy. During the month of Bharadrapada, explained Ravid, sometime in August or September, the faithful flock in homage and hope. Infertile women pray for barrenness to be lifted, pregnant for a good fortune of the son. To effect the latter, married couples must bathe together. The wife's sari tied to her husband's dhoti, whatever that is. As she bathes, the woman is expected to release some vegetables from simple fertility into the water. Those suffering skin diseases have their clothes, leave their clothes behind. How many people come to so small a spot? 20,000 all in one day, mostly in two, exclamation mark. The spiritual pool of Varanasi is felt throughout India. Some Hindus' weddings, even today, the groom will appear at the doorway of the bride's home shortly before the extensive marriage rites and declare his future father-in-law that he is leaving for Varanasi to renounce the world. But it's a ritual threat and initiates a round of pleading and bargaining in which the bride's family inevitably dissuades him. The gifts and promises from his noble goal, although one wonders some unimpressed future-in-law might choose not and wheedle the young man back. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, David was delighted to display his learning as he led me through the city's most cherished buildings. Hindu tradition is more than a lifetime study. Its complex myths, its manifold divine identities, its elaborate rituals, its teaching about life and death. Those who lead a good life have brightness in their face. Dejas. Sun is compassionate, healing, friendly. Ravid continue. But Hindus believe that you must not turn the page. My God. Follow a shadow, for it entails misfortune. Not tread on another's shadow, for it will drive him mad. Isn't that amazing? Do not tread on a man's shadow. By now, it was nearly 6 in the evening. Few people were about. Just as some children were playing hopscotch, the odd mangy dog, and some monkeys, after sunset. You can imagine this pool with vegetable soups and skin disease, my God. After sunset, a better class of person stays at home while the untouchables scavenge for leftovers from the public wells or collect the warm droppings of cows to sell for fuel. It's time to return to my hotels. My godfather. Okay. Next morning I was up at 5:40, as soon joined by Ravid, whose forehead was marked with a rohi, red turmeric. Different sects have different colours and signs. Red for the sun worshippers. We wound our way through the crumbling stone alleys no wider than footpaths, and walked along the row of ghats or landings, whose staircases extended root-like into the river. Some of the landings, 84 in all, stretch along just one side of the river, where the most deserted. Others thronged with peoples as we wended our way. This is 5:40 in the morning. As we wended our way past the walking friskers and stallholders putting out their wares, bright orange garlands, ghee for lamps, costumes of jewellery, brass pots, trays, bowls, wooden toys, plastic water cans, bottles of water, and the evening before I had read the 19th century traveller's description. Up and down ghats all day long, but especially the early morning stream of endless course of pilgrims, ragged tramps, aged crones, horrible beggars, hawkers, barmen, priests, sacred bulls, cows, Hindu preachers, wealthy rajas and bankers, in gay placards, fakirs, pariah dogs and scoffing globe trotters. Not much seems to have changed in the 110 years since. At last we came into sight of skiff Ravid had hired and trotted carefully over the hardened mud of the sandbank to board it. Our oarsman was about 40, small but sinewy and seeming impervious to my presence. For him, just another day at the office. That has a term in Australia. Another day in the office means that there's a bad guy doing bad things to disrupt your day. Just another day in the office, nothing's changed. Although it's not yet dawn, it was light enough, and we began to move slowly down the river. I could see some people already at prayer, a few having their hair or beard cut by the street barber, others preparing themselves for immersion in the great Ganga. Before sunrise, the water is said to be not just warm, but hot. After sunrise, cooler. Generally, the women come to bathe first, early at 4 a.m, and will go away, go to any of the ghats in a line of the river's edge. Varanasi sits between two streams. The Vana, Avirta, which flows to the Ganges on the north, and the Lesser Ansi, Sword, which joins to the river to the south. Okay. Ravid, with defences about Ganges' reputation of being heavily polluted. The great river has amoeba-like bacteria, which he said, and these eat harmful bacteria. All harmful bacteria? Much harmful bacteria. We follow the river, that is probably true, isn't it? We follow the river in ghats alternating between the pavilions, temples and terraces that crowd the banks. Most of them hypotonically beautiful in the morning light, which the sunrise tinted a uniform coral red. The local cactus, Rigulus persica, seemed to sprout everywhere. As we passed the Dig Panther Ghat, a chant arose from the gathering priest. We slipped by an imposing 12th century ruin, overrun by vagrants and goats. A wide expanse of the riverbank had been covered with saris and laid out to dry. A feast of colour, full length of each 20 feet. Oh, that's a sari, 20 feet long, my God. Inevitably, Mark Twain had come here and once wrote without aiming a comic effect. Quote, this is from Mark Twain. The Ganges front is the supreme showpass of Benares. Its tall bluffs are solidly caked with from warm water to summer. Along the stretch of 3 miles, with a splendid jumble of massive picturesque masonry, a bewildering and beautiful confusion of stone platforms, temples, stair flights, rich and stately palaces, nowhere a break, nowhere a glimpse of the bluff itself. All the long face of its complacency walked from sights by this cramped perspective of platforms. Soaring stairways, sculptured temples, majestic palaces, softening always into the distance. There is movement, motion, human life everywhere, and brilliantly costumed, streaming in rainbows up and down the lofty stairways, amassed in metaphorical flower gardens, on the miles of great platform at the river's edge. Well, okay, well, I have progressed somewhere. I did not mentally read any of that. It was just another part of my brain reading. Okay, there's a footnote here, and I've got to read it. As the sun rose to the sky, I could see men and women of all ages practicing breath control, meditation disciplines for the yogic sunrise ceremony of Sarakanamska, which requires one to bow 108 times. In the late 50s, the longest name of this name in the world belonged to an Indian prince who required Sanjaya, the sun, to be included exactly that number of times. Sun's 108 times. The sunset similar ceremony is enacted with a minimum of 9 bows. What I have to say is that, of course, I wasn't coping well, saw a psychologist who also ran a yoga studio. I had a valve problem. I couldn't breathe. And she said, practice breathing, yoga, mind control. And of course, my valve was going, I can't breathe. Okay. It sort of stressed you out. Okay. So I've always got a thought about breath control. Since my visit, the question of whether school children should be required by law to take up the sun salutation has become a serious topic. In 2007, Hindu nationalists led the government to the state of Madrid preach to put forward a measure to require the public school students to salute the sun and recite certain chants in Sanskrit, but Muslims and Christians took issue, saying the chants were essentially a Hindu rite, violating the constitutional separation of faith and state. A court later ruled that neither the chants nor the salutation should be compulsory, but an issue remains contentious. Well, that's pretty amazing. So salute the sun. Some men were already out hosing down the silt piled up on their seasonal flooding, while others raised hands cupped to hold the sacred water for supplication, or clutched the ceremony kush grass used to performing their rites. The elder of 70, completely bald, 3 deep furrows in his forehead etched in yellow, gazed and rapt towards the horizon. Everyone seemed caught up in his or her own world. Most of the men were burly, certainly not slim, following my eyes. Ravid explained that Vanissi was famous for its wrestlers. Hello, darling. Side here. Of course, Plato was a wrestler. There you go. 3 women were busily washing one another using polystyrene bags as cloth. 2 girls splashing about joyfully. The older woman was doing her best to preserve her modesty while bathing in a mineral sari. One beautiful mother, about 18, carried a baby, turning 7 times around, as the holy book describes, to cleanse herself and the child before the gods. Several bathers, up to their waists, were scouring their teeth with twigs from a holy tree. After the ablutions, Most of those I watch crowded into temples along the river, their hands full of jasmine sweets destined for the lap of the favoured god, or else they carried waters home to polish in polished pots made from brass for which the city is celebrated. One of the greatest Indian poets, Kabir, at maybe 1440 to 1518, although he lived in Varanasi, couldn't resist heaping respect on his hometown. Going on the endless pilgrimages, the world died exhausted by so much bathing. Maybe so, but those who had braved the waters were not only ones making use of the river. As we glided along, Ravid pointed out Margaret Ghat, the larger of two main places of cremation, the only points along the river where photography is forbidden, although the bodies are emoliated almost everywhere. This burning ground has traditionally gone by yet another name, Jansat Ghat, the sleeper on the waters, and the host's sacred fire said to have burned constantly for all history. Further along, another main cremation centre, the Harishchandra Ghat, I suppose Ghat means port, there now stands an electric crematorium where funeral pyres once blazed. Most prefer the older way. Okay, dear. All may be cremated, Ravid said, except snake bite victims, pregnant women, children, and victims of smallpox. What snake bite victims? Cremations by flames cost 551 rupees. Mekinai version, 151 rupees. The thing is that you realize that numbers are intensely important to Hindus. I know that because I've employed a few Hindus, and I would they come around and why are these products here? Well, they've got the wrong numbers. Why is this invoice skipped? Well, that's a bad number. It's pretty amazing. The burnings go on without cease, each taking 3 or 4 hours. The great stocks of wood that line the shore, higher than houses, are even being replenished as depleted. As we drifted slowly by, the smoke wafted up, low-lying pyres and curl about the temples around the sites. I could smell charring flesh. Fuck, dead. When a body arrives, dead women draped in orange, men in white. I'll burn me by the Ganges, I may as well. Explain Ravid. It's dipped in the Ganges and then taken to the funeral pyre where it's sprinkled with sandalwood oil and garland. Tall bamboo poles dot the scene, each hung out a small basket with oil lamps on it. See you, Virginia. Are you going now?
Oh, no, I'm just getting
Okay. Tall bamboo poles dot the scene, each hung with a small basket filled with oil lamps to honour the ancestors of those passing through the fire. What? So you can't be, if you have a snake bite, you can't be burnt. Wherever possible, the eldest and youngest son of the dead will take the central part in the ceremony. He will have had his head and eyebrows freshly shaven, and he will be clad in a seamless long white shirt, with a sacred thread usually hangs from the left shoulder cast over the right. He will lead the mourners 5 times around the unlit pyre, anti-clockwise, because death, everything is reversed, and he will light the pyre. Once the body is near consumed, the chief mourner performs the rite of the skull, cracking the head with a bamboo stick, so releasing the soul from entrapment. He turns a tekasa pot of the Ganges water over his shoulder, dousing the embers, and strides away. Virginia, just really quickly, I just found out you can't be cremated. The Hindu religions forbid you to be cremated if you've had a snake bite. Fact, yeah, love it. Okay, go enjoy, sorry. Yep, oh, okay. See, people are not really interested. I wanted to venture beyond the formal line. Okay. So crack the skull. Then turns to cast pots, to the cast pots of Ganges water over his left shoulder, dousing the embers as he strides away. I wanted to venture beyond the normal line of Ghats, so Ravind and I disembarked and walked on through the city. Before he left me, I asked Ravid to join me that evening so that during the rituals he could explain anything I didn't understand. He grinned, of course. Back at my hotel, I returned to Dania Eric's classic history, Barras, the City of Light. A distinguished visitor to Vanessa, she writes, described the drawing riverfront as one vast sun temple, and yet it's not the sun alone which is honoured. It is the divine of many names and forms, their physically manifest presence of warmth and light. How much of this devotion centres on the sun and how much on other powers? Let me get the snake bites, pregnant women, smallpox, those things can't get cremated. And when you do get cremated, anti-clockwise, 5 times around, and at a certain point, the oldest sun breaks open your head with a bamboo pole. What's this? Let me see, the right of the skull, cracking the head with a bamboo head, so releasing the soul from entrapment. I had a chance to ask these questions a few hours later, when Ravid accompanied me to a meeting he had arranged with Dr. Saduka Mashka, eminent scholar of Sanskrit at the professor's house. My host was a friendly, if earnest figure, as intent as Ravid on enlightening me of my ignorance, and began by explaining something of an Indian attitude towards eclipses, breaking off only abruptly one of his many children who scampered about the delight at having as unusual visitors. Okay, and I do remember him explaining, but I can't remember. I do remember him explaining, but I can't remember what he said about eclipses. As soon as it was time, he instructed me in 3 levels of sun worship. The mystic, where the sun is part of a ritualistic framework. The astronomic, where it's king of the stars. In southern India, for instance, it's the basis of the calendar. And every day, where it's an intrinsic part of normal life. Without sun worship, Dr. Mishra concluded, nothing is going to happen in Banaras. The sun has a soul, he said, Sutrama. Inside each one of us is a small map of the universe, somewhere near the bridge of the nose. Proper meditation releases this knowledge and trillions of galaxies within us. Hinduism recognizes 330 million gods. Well, there you go. Isn't that incredible? I've forgotten what he said about eclipses. All gone. I read that and I got the benefit of podcasting, but I can't remember. I remember people banging drums to get rid of eclipses. I interjected that it was a crazy number, perhaps a metaphor for many facets of gods. No, he interrupted, suddenly leaning towards me. There really are that many, and Hinduism honours each one of them. In the vastness of the universe, is that not so surprising? The West likes its cleanliness outside, not inside, he added, so does not understand. We have no solutions for you. What is God? That you ask, just as useful to demand, what is the colour of pain? There is no answer. Nor could I come up with one, although my mind returned to the white shrouds of the funeral pyres. By the time Ravid and I took our leave and strolled together at the back of the town, the sun was about to set, and the 2 of the main gates were filling up, although the honorary service would not start until at least half an hour later at around 6:30. The largest landing, the Dalawishli Warmth Ghat, already hosted about 400 people, many of them having taken off their shoes, including women, the majority dressed in their finest saris. Rows of pilgrim priests huddled under bamboo umbrellas on low wooden chaukis. 7 small altars draped in fine orange silk, ruby silk being reserved for the central order, altar, were lined up the river's edge, and acolytes passed from one another, checking that all was in order. Flowers, incense, joss sticks, special fans for each priest would use, conches, bells, combustibles, prasada, consecrated food. I wanted to ask Ravid about all of these, but he had wandered off the melee, into the melee. I found space directly behind the main altar, giving me unimpaired view. A large portrait had been placed on the altar, framed with white and red flowers. Ashran Rupu, a local holy man, beside me, a whippet-thin devotee of about 50, was already at prayer. I felt awkward, stealing glances at him. Above the altars, a large sign flapped in the wind. Gaya Na Sava, the major corporation that subsidized the nightly ceremonies. The stone step afforded easy sitting, but many could still have to stand. Behind the altars, scores of tourist-laden boats had started the jockey for position, while the minute leaf cockerels bobbed their lamps of ghee and camphor a long galaxy of lights under the perfect crescent moon. From somewhere along the river rose a rhythmic popping of firecrackers. The atmosphere had changed as it was the theatre just before the curtain goes up. At last, seven young priests, clad in orange skirts, light orange shoulder sashes, white trousers, and strings of beads, took up their places at the altar. Suddenly, Ravid appeared at my side, evidently agitated. "You must come with me," he said sharply. I rose and followed. He took me to a small boat, manned by some oarsmen we had that morning. For a moment, I thought we just wanted to ensure a good vantage point. But after a bit, he calmed down enough to explain. The year before, a bomb had been set off almost exactly where I'd been sitting. 20 worshippers had died. The government had whitewashed the atrocity as a simple matter of gas cylinders exploding, but locals are sure that it was the work of provocateurs planted by the Pakistani intelligence. No evidence was offered either way. The bomb was said to have been set off at 6:45, when it should have killed several hundred people, but it exploded at 16:45. Aha. Uh-huh. Isn't that amazing? Soon after the bomb... As soon as I boarded our skiff, seven priests, their black hair glistening under the lights, began to intone a great rumbling. And soon I began to lose myself in the extraordinary tableau around me. Huge, vividly coloured umbrellas, each a good 8 feet cloth, lined the shores, maybe 20 on one side, the gap 30 on the other. More than 1,000 spectators had gathered on the shore by now. And now the river, a further 500 boats, so hunger-mugger, that the young girl selling lamps skipped shoeless from one to another. The priests, this is amazing, isn't that beautiful? The priests eventually ceased their chantings and began to sound conch shells, turning east and north to other gods, and finally west to honor the sun. The conches were meant to echo the Om resonance, Ravi explained. Next they raised seven branch candelabra, symbolizing the world's hierarchy of species, and began to chant again, a new rhyme, once this part of the service is completed. Om, sometimes written as Om, is the verbal symbol of supreme reality, and it consists of five separate sounds, A-U-M plus nasalization, bindu, and resonance. One temple of Resi consists of five shrines, one for each of these notes, my God. Raise it outside. Once the part of service was completed, they raised her outside fans, like peacock feathers, only tasseled made of cow's hair. Ravid explained, this repels small bees and flies, as well as disease and bacteria. Then once more, they made their four turns as they invoke the Vishnu, then the Shiva. One another surged to Om, less synchronized before. There rose a clamour of bells, and the priests chanted for the peace of the world. Om Shanti, Om Shanti, I remember that. That's in yoga. Then the high priest cast flowers over the dark current as the final homage to many gods, the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars. The ceremony is over. The great assembly began to break up as we pushed off, first leading upriver, where the cremation flames still smoldered. The rich beads of pyres yield. The idea at the end of cremation breaking open the skull is just, I can't believe it. Near the banks, the water was strewn with human ashes and bits of bone. Now, it was nearly 8 o'clock, and the neighbouring ghats were most of the party deserted, except for the occasional stray animal and prowling for scraps, obviously, of humans. In Jeff Dwyer's recent novel, set in Varanasi, his narrator offers a dyspeptic view of the rites that I have just watched. You didn't have a particularly discerning tourist to see that this was an exhausted pageant drummed up for tourists, a sun illuminae with a cast of hundreds. Gee. Any significance it was supposed to have had been drained possibly a long time ago, or maybe just yesterday, or even now, right before our very eyes. Why do I not deny the tourists have gone off to their beds happily but completely ignorant of the meaning of what they had just seen? I sensed a genuine reverence among the celebrants themselves. As with Kuzu, celebrations of their summer solstice, or noisy crowds circling Stonehenge, or even a small group of travellers who watched the moon pass across the sun at the Antarctic ice, a feeling of awe, even sometimes like fear, had filled the air, a tribute paid to the forces that hold Nature, Life, and Death. It's beautiful the way he's pulling it together, because these are all these things. While our oarsman turned about and pulled hard against the current towards the steps closest to my hotel, the air was chill above. On the main buildings, a banner read in English, Barra is Barras. Barras was Barras. Barras will be Barras. We passed the Darashagat with the young priests and their helpers. We're clearing the fittings and instruments away. Like orderlies in an operating theatre, they will perform the same ceremony, the following censer, and the next. In their language, Kal means both yesterday and tomorrow. Isn't that beautiful?
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.